I want to say thanks again to Dave Foley for joining us for 2 hours of calls, comments, questions from the Coast to Coast listeners. I appreciate all those callers as well. Some really good points brought up. It's good to hear from people all over the country and North America. And a time like this, it's very challenging. Things are going to get worse before they get better. And it's good to be communicating with each other, and that means talking, not necessarily yelling, because we're all going to need each other before this is over. So we might do that again. I might do that in a segment in a future program and check in and see how things are going maybe next weekend and hear from some of you folks as well. But as I said, we're switching gears now. We're going to the other side of the world. J.P. Haig is the National Director of MUFON in the country of Mauritius, which is an Indian Ocean island nation, a republic off the coast of Madagascar. And he's an attorney who has had some UFO sightings of his own. He's sort of become unofficially kind of drafted to be the UFO man in his country. There have been three major cases that he has investigated and wants to share with us. And there might be a connection to a U.S. military base at Diego Garcia. We're going to get into that and a lot more right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Earlier this year in Laughlin, Nevada, the organizers, Bob Brown and his team, put on what's called UFO MegaCon. Really big event, goes on for a full week, a couple of dozen speakers from around the world. And there was one who jumped out at me. I was really impressed by his presentation, his professionalism. And we sat down to do a TV interview, and I thought he'd be a great guest for Coast to Coast. Of course, UFO MegaCon, if it had been scheduled for right now, would not be possible. It'd have to be canceled. And I think there'd be a lot of big UFO events around the country and maybe around the world that are likewise being canceled or put off. And it's a shame. I guess a lot of people in the UFO community are maybe feeling a little disconnected right now because these events are not happening. And I suspect there'll be more cancellations in the future. But we've got J.P. Haig here to tell us about the UFO situation in his country. We all know generally where Madagascar is, probably because of a couple of animated movies. But it has a neighbor, Mauritius, a republic. It's its own country, an island nation, and we're going to learn about more about it right now. JP, or should I call you Jonathan? Which you prefer?
George, good evening. It's JP is fine. It's great to be here with you.
Okay.
So nice to see you in Las Vegas and regroup here during this crisis.
Yeah, thank you for being here with us. I don't want to dwell too much on the virus, but I was curious about how it's going there. Are you under the same sort of concerns and restrictions that we are?
Yes, we are, George. We had a patient zero who arrived into Mauritius from the UK on the 7th of March. And since then, we've now got officially 28 cases, and we've had two deaths. And I think, from what I've read, if we multiply that by five in terms of the official cases, so approximately 350 people may have the virus and we don't know about it. But what I will say is that the government has reacted very quickly. We're now in a total lockdown and curfew. It's not ideal, but it's the only way to slow down the bell curve of the virus and to really assist the medical staff that are here. So we've got 28 official cases and two deaths as it stands today.
I've read a little bit about your country, and I want you to share with us just some general background information. I mean, I don't even know what is the population of Mauritius, and what and how modern and capable are your hospitals?
Yeah, well, we have a population here of 1.3 million. It is technically a second world, developing world country. So, there are free hospitals for the public. There's also private clinics available. But I think that if there was a real surge in cases that came through, that there would be real difficulty in managing that. So what I've understood from a press conference that happened last night with the Prime Minister, that China has been sought after, and they're going to be helping with medical supplies and such other things to help support the response here. But I mean, there have been a lot of people that have been caught going out to the beach and so on. But I would say overall, people have responded very calmly and sensibly. And now they're starting to allocate how people can go out and get their food shopping. So, It's being managed quite well, I think. So I'm quietly impressed and also quietly hopeful that we'll be able to see this out without too much of an impact on the country and the economy. And as it stands, we've got 2 weeks of lockdown. It could be increased to beyond that, which I'm actually expecting. But it puts an immense amount of pressure on everybody across the full spectrum of society. I mean, just before coming on air, I was getting my son ready. I picked up what looked to be a mop and started using it. It didn't come with any batteries or instructions, but we got through.
So it is a lockdown or a suggested lockdown? I mean,
you guys in the States will call it martial law. There's going to be police on the streets and maybe even the military police to enforce this. But they're doing a really good job. Most people seem to be respecting it, but there have been cases of people going out and playing football, and obviously the videos have hit social media. But I think overall they've responded just in the nick of time, and we should get through this. We're a very small country, and we're one of the last to actually pick up the virus, and it did come in through the UK. But what they've been able to do is trace some of the family members and contacts that patient zero came into contact with, and he sadly died yesterday, I believe. He was aged 58 or 59. But what's really strange is the pathology of this virus. It seems to be quite indiscriminate. We all hear about, you know, the vulnerable being the most susceptible to the virus, but you know, you've got 12-year-olds, 15-year-olds, all kinds of people who are affected, and it clearly aggressively attacks the lungs. So you know, we're certainly respecting the curfew. It is a very fine balance between democracy and autocracy, but I think in this case it's the right thing to do.
Your country, I think, is dependent on tourism, the economy would be challenged at this point if there are restrictions on
tourism. Yes, all the flights have stopped. At one point, there was even a freeze on Mauritian nationals coming back, which is anti-constitutional. So, you know, fortunately, they've been able to, they've been let back in. And what's been really encouraging is to see that many of the hotel groups here have obviously closed, but they're offering their hotel accommodation for quarantine. So, you know, there is a really good group effort that's happening here. And I do ask myself whether it would be better to actually be in quarantine in a 5-star hotel, some of the finest hotels in the world, than stuck at home. But, you know, there is a serious side to this, obviously.
So you are an attorney, and we don't have a lot of attorneys who are involved with the UFO question. You've taken this head on, sort of taken the bull by the horns, and now are kind of the point man for the whole country, right? Or am I exaggerating?
Well, I guess I am, yes. I mean, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm originally from England, the south of England, UK. And about 7 years ago, after the birth of our daughter, who's now seven, she came into our lives while we were living in London. And then we moved outside of London, and then we came here to Mauritius. So basically the quality of life, the family life that it's offered us, and it's definitely done that. At the time, when I was in the UK, I was starting to experience the phenomena firsthand, kind of coincided with researching it. And what struck me was it was probably late 2010 to the first opening month or two of 2011, which was the year in which I got married to my wife. We were living in central London at that time, and you know, I was deeply researching the subject. It was literally taking over my life, because a friend of mine, who is an engineer and basically helps to run the computer systems of an international bank in Canary Wharf in London. And one evening we went over to his place for dinner, my wife and I with his wife. And out of the blue, he started to discuss the UFO subject, and he said to me, "I've got some footage I want to share with you." And what he was showing me was basically what appeared to be footage from a deep space telescope such as Hubble or some kind of other apparatus. And what you could see were what I can only describe as etheric or partially formed spaceships. And my initial reaction was, "That's amazing. How did how did they Photoshop this?" And he laughed and he said, "Well, you know, that it is a moot point. We don't really know." And anyway, it captured my imagination. I'd already had an interest in the paranormal because I'd seen and experienced some strange things. But the UFO and ET subject hadn't really come to me before this point in time. So anyway, I'm walking through back from a cinema trip with my wife. Maybe it was a science fiction film, I don't really know. But we're walking on a fairly elevated point in central London called Primrose Hill, down to St. John's Wood, and then on to where we lived in a place called Maida Vale. And it was a beautiful, crisp, clear winter's afternoon. It was probably around 3 p.m., and the sky was blue. I'm suddenly thinking about the subject in my mind, and on a balance of probabilities, which is the civil burden of proof in a court of law, on a balance of probabilities, I was intellectually persuaded that the phenomenon was absolutely happening. But there was something deeper within me that sat quite uncomfortably. It just seemed so fanciful and far-fetched that I couldn't quite fully embrace it. So at that very moment in time, I remember saying to myself, is this, in my mind's eye, is this phenomenon real or not? And at the moment those words, you know, came into my mind, an object pulsed into reality over the London skyline, fairly low in the sky. And it took the shape of a rhombus or a diamond-shaped object. It was metallic. And every time it pulsed into reality or physicality, it was reflecting the sunlight. So I knew that it was materially there, but then it was disappearing, and it must have pulsed around five times. And it happened to do this at the very moment that I'd asked the question, is this phenomenon real or not? I mean, my wife at the time didn't actually see it because she was on a tree-lined avenue or pavement, and I was already in the street. I was sort of on the outside of the pavement. As soon as I saw this thing, I jumped into the road, which was empty, and just, you know, couldn't take my eyes off of it. So, you know, it answered my question at that point in time, I suppose. And as I got deeper into the subject, it was evident to me that was a genuine information block across particularly the Occidental world and the States and the UK. And which meant, you know, there was something to hide. So that was late 2010 to 2011. We fast forward a year or two. We're living in we'd moved out of London. Our daughter had just been born. We'd moved into a beautiful countryside town called East Grinstead, which is about an hour from London. And the plan was to continue living in the UK and basically commute into London whilst my wife would look after our daughter. But anyway, we basically bought this house that can only be described as haunted. You know, there were cupboards and doors opening as soon as you walked out the room. There was so much going on, so much activity, banging underneath the master bedroom. The electrics were cut out, newly refurbished kitchen. You could hear the chairs being pulled out. And, I just thought, what is going on? Anyway, I looked into it, and basically one of these so-called ley lines runs directly underneath East Grinstead. And I'm sort of putting all this information together, and what I'm picturing is that there is a multidimensional type phenomenon that's occurring across the spectrum. And I think it basically concerns all paranormal phenomena. Of course, the origins of the phenomena may vary at some level or other, but there is this multidimensional aspect to it. In the end, we decided to move to Mauritius. It got a bit too much with all the activity that was happening in the house. And, you know, I think it's quite normal.
Meaning
for
ongoing.
To, gravitate towards her mother. So she left with my daughter, and I basically just tied up the ends in the UK. I should mention, by the way, the town we moved into is the UK Scientology and European Scientology headquarters location for the church internationally. And the actor, Tom Cruise, is often, visiting the town to stay there. And bizarrely, in I think it was December of 2011, there was a famous UFO case that hit the UK national headlines in East Grinstead, the town where we had moved in, and this Scientology headquarters was based, maybe 2 to 3 miles away from our home. But anyway, on that fateful evening in December of 2011, I think it was six British Airways jet pilots had visually seen 3 to 6. What can only be described as flying saucers, metallic flying saucers, that were literally hovering over this UK Scientology headquarters. And not only that, the radar at London Gatwick Airport had also picked up the same thing. And by the way, they call it London Gatwick Airport. It's one of the UK's largest airports, but it's nowhere near London. London is about 70 miles away, and the airport is in my home county of West Sussex. So it's a really curious and fascinating place. There has been a lot of attention on the site for this UFO sighting. Scientology, famous visitors like John Travolta and Tom Cruise, and the ley lines that run through, or a ley line that runs through this location. So come, I would say, May 2013, our daughters arrived. We decide to move to Mauritius. Now, Mauritius is somewhere that I've been visiting for, since 2004, so a good decade beforehand. But to go and live somewhere, you know, outside of your own country permanently is another thing altogether. It's, you know, tropical in climate. It's totally beautiful. Mark Twain once described it in one of his books, and he said that from one citizen you can gather the idea that Mauritius was made first, and then heaven was copied after Mauritius. So that was Mark Twain's impression of the island. He was actually also making a political statement on the slavery trade that was happening on the island at the time. It was one of the, unfortunately, the central points in the world where slaves were brought. As you mentioned earlier, we're about 560 miles east of Madagascar, which is a much larger country and made famous by the wonderful Pixar and Disney film franchise, which I enjoy watching with my kids. The island is about 38 miles long and about 30 miles in width, so it's about twice the size of Hong Kong, and it lies just north of the Tropic of Capricorn, and it's absolutely volcanic in nature. It is part of a volcanic series of islands, of which some are submerged. As I mentioned, there's about 1.3 million people living on the island, and about 80% of them are living in and around the capital of Port Louis.
And multicultural, right?
Sorry, could you say that again, George?
It's a multicultural country, a lot of influences from different European countries as well as indigenous people.
Absolutely right, yes. I mean, Mauritius, the kind of the human history is relatively recent and modern. What we know is that Arab traders from modern-day Oman and Austronesian sailors, I think it was as early as the 10th century, around the end of 1000 AD, I want to say, first spotted the island. And then Portuguese sailors first came here in the early 1500s, and they basically used it as a stopping-off point on their spice route, trading route. But their main base was in Mozambique, which is on the upper east coast of Africa. So the Portuguese navigators preferred to use the island as a stop-off point on the way to India and trading spices. The country itself, or the island, was first plotted on a map that was made by a Portuguese cartographer at the time. And this map was smuggled out of Portugal to Italy on the orders of a certain Duke of Ferrara. And it was a guy from Italy that did this in 1502. Mauritius forms part of three islands. Then they're called the Mascarene Islands. Reunion Island is about 100 miles off the west coast, and that's actually part of France. It's an overseas territory still. Then we have Mauritius, where we are, which is an independent republic as of 1994 and was given independence in 1968 under British colonial rule. And Mauritius also has a sister island called Rodrigue Island, which is really beautiful, and there's a lot of spice and fruits, and I think it's octopus that they fish for and sell, and it's a beautiful island. And you know, the Arabs gave them their names. It was Dina Maghrebin, Dina Harobi for Mauritius, and Dina Morari for
JP. I'll have to interrupt you there for a second. JP Haig is my guest. We're going to get into a pretty tremendous UFO case that happened in his now adopted homeland, Mauritius. We'll be right back. We're talking with JP Haig, who just unloaded a pile of information about a lifetime of experiences, including a UFO incident, and I'm using air quotes around UFO, in which he was thinking about them, and one just appeared. Metallic rhombus is how he described it, which suggests that it is something beyond just a nuts and bolts craft. We're going to get into what it might represent, and then the bigger case that he's been investigating in his home country right after this on Coast to Coast AM. J.P. Haig, you crammed a lot of information into about a 12-minute segment there, and I wanted to go back and cover this a little bit more in detail. You had said that you had an ongoing interest in paranormal activity before you got interested in UFOs, and then shared with us a story about living in what seemed to be a haunted house. Was there something earlier in your life that had intervened in your life earlier?
Yeah, I suppose there's been lots of strange little things, but I just kind of dismissed them as, you know, a glitch of some kind, or that maybe it was normal, and or I was seeing things, that kind of thing. I mean, when I was younger, I mean, you literally can't make this up. I mean, I suppose you can, but I'm not. But I would literally see little objects in my bedroom levitate and slowly hover across the room and then put themselves back down again. I mean, I called up one of my best friends at school at the time. I must have been about, 16. So little odd things that would happen. But it was really when we moved to this town of, East Grinstead in 2012, so much stuff happened. I mean, when we were looking for a house to buy for our family, before the house that we purchased, we looked at a coach house, which was easily over 100 years old. And we viewed this property. It must have been around midday. It was, you know, clear as they come in terms of weather. And, you know, the owner greeted us at the door, but she seemed a little bit nervous, and I wasn't really sure why. She showed us upstairs. She showed us a small bedroom, which was kind of situated in the middle of the house. She walks in, then my wife walks in, and then I walk in. The sun was literally coming through the window, and a beam of light was coming through the room, you know, a ray of the sun. But as soon as I got in there, I thought, this is a really old and dusty house. There's so much dust in the air. It's really thick. But what happened was that the dust appeared to vibrate, and this sort of vibration of the dust became quicker and quicker to the point where I was literally looking at a woman, a very tall, what I can only describe as a woman or a being in a white kind of flowing robe. And this apparition then just approached me and then walked through me. And the sensation that I had was actually very warm. I would describe electrostatic kind of electricity or energy around my face. And I felt very at ease and calm, but it was bizarre. And I just jumped and I said to my wife and the owner, did you just see that? And they said, what? And I said, what just happened? There was an apparition, there was a woman that looked at me, she was facing me, and then she walked through me. And I said to her, look, are you trying to sell us a haunted house? Is this why you feel a little on edge? And she said, yes, she said, yes, I'll come clean. That's exactly why we're looking to sell this house. We've not seen anything, but at night we have seen, you know, flickers of light. We've heard a disembodied voice, and we feel watched when we're, you know, alone in the evening. And I thanked her and said, I think this probably isn't the house for us, but, you know, appreciate your time. But that was really the first major apparition. I mean, I'd already been watching shows like Ghost Hunters, and I was kind of persuaded that this was actually happening. But I think when you start to analyze and reanalyze the nature of reality itself, none of this is really particularly far-fetched. It's just if we look at it in terms of frequencies and dimensions, possibly parallel dimensions, there's a lot of theories, and we can get into those if you want later. It kind of makes sense, and we shouldn't deny ourselves these experiences and stop adding to the empirical evidence. I mean, you mentioned earlier I'm a lawyer, and one of the last questions you asked me when we had a really great conversation in Las Vegas together was, you know, how do you feel about this as an attorney and a lawyer? But, you know, my approach is we need to look at this objectively. We should maintain the scientific method, but we need to go beyond that too. We should be hooked to it, but I think we need to go beyond, and we shouldn't be dismissing, these kinds of subjective metaphysical experiences, but we should try to seek to understand them, no matter how hard it may be to explain it. And, you know, that's why I really looked up to you, George, because you kind of came out and really rigorously and fearlessly pursued this subject at a time when it was ultra taboo compared to now. So that was the first major paranormal apparition in terms of non-UFO ET or extra-dimensional beings or intelligences that I've had. But it was really moving to Mauritius where things ramped up almost immediately. I mean, when we moved here, we moved into the upstairs or the first floor apartment of my wife's parents, my in-laws. And one evening, this was September of 2013, my father-in-law asked me to just move the car because it's quite an enclosed area and there was a neighbor that needed to come in. So obviously I did. When I got outside to move the car, I saw this enormous bright elliptical object that was just sitting in the sky. And it would have been located over a small town called Albion on the west coast. And Albion is Old English for England, where I'd just come from. So it was this, it could have been up to 3 to 5 miles, I'd say between 3 and 5 miles in width. I thought I was hallucinating and that I was very tired. So I just went to bed. And the next morning I woke up and had my breakfast, and it was all over the radio. There had been multiple sightings across that region. And little did I know, and it really does concern a witness in one of the major cases that I've looked into here, the witness who I later met, it would have been 3 years afterwards, just less than 3 years, was actually chasing this thing when it moved along that very coast. And this is another aspect that I find in this field. There's an aspect of entanglement in terms of connections and people who know one another, similarities, that kind of thing. It's like a network. The intelligence or intelligences seems to have this means of organizing in the background, and life just kind of unfolds, and coincidences or synchronicities, if we want to use the Jungian terminology, seem to just happen and fall into place. And I imagine that you've come across this in your own work.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about your description of the metallic rhombus, and you're sitting there thinking about UFOs, and boom, this thing appears. After having a lifetime of different kinds of experiences that some would say is paranormal or poltergeistish, and then you get introduced to the UFO world in a very dramatic way, it can't help but dawn on you that they are somehow related. That, you know, you go to a UFO conference like UFO MegaCon, and people tend to put things in little boxes. Here's ghosts over here, and here's Bigfoot over here, and crop circles over there, and then there's UFOs. But the longer you stay with the subject, the more you see interconnectedness.
That's right. Completely agree. And it was actually, you know, sometimes we have to go backwards in time in order to go forwards. And there's some amazing researchers and journalists such as yourself that have really uncovered the sort of raw elements. And I think the trickery of the subject, which goes into, again, Jungian-type analysis, the trickery is to kind of be deceived by the eye in terms of how this evolves over time and the new elements or aspects to it. I mean, you know, in the late, 19th century, there was this airship kind of appearances that were happening over the States, you know, before their time. We go to June of 1947, and, you know, the first flying saucer was reported. A month later, we have Roswell. Then we get on to triangular craft in the 90s, and now it's becoming a little bit more exotic and, I would say, multidimensional. But it doesn't mean necessarily that the origins are different in terms of, in terms of the metaphysical side of things. I mean, absolutely, there are physical extraterrestrials, in my opinion, who are from different parts of the cosmos and other dimensions, too. But I think, you know, we have to keep removing the layers of the onion in order to actually get to the origin. And ultimately, in my opinion, this leads down a spiritual path. I just wanted to, you know, very quickly quote you something from Jacques Vallée, who's really one of the leading minds in the field. Like you said, he says that the UFOs are physical manifestations that simply cannot be understood apart from their psychic and symbolic reality. So this psychic and symbolic aspect to it is totally linked. He goes on to say, what we see here is not, and I repeat, not an alien invasion. It is a spiritual system that acts on humans and uses humans. And that's from his book, Dimensions, A Casebook of Alien Contact. And I really recommend this book. I mean, I recommend all of his books. But for me, he really hit the nail on the head here. We can get easily deceived by the physical aspects, the kind of military-industrial complex and liaisons that they may be having with various different kinds of visitors across the world. But, you know, at a deeper level, I think that we are seeing a hierarchy of a kind of management and between worlds, communication, messengers. And none of this is really anything new under the sun. It's all in the ancient traditions and spiritual traditions, mystical traditions, and also in psychology and shamanism. I think we have to really take a broad spectrum approach to this. And as you absolutely rightly said, not just pigeonhole everything, because if we do that, then I think we can miss the target.
Let's talk about the really big case incident that happened in Mauritius that you, I don't know about how you became the MUFON guy, but maybe that would be a segue into, did you see a UFO or have a UFO experience and then became a MUFON guy, or you were the MUFON guy first and then it happened?
No, it was the former, George. You're right. Okay. Basically, I began to have so many experiences that at the end of 2018, I just thought, right, I have to act on this, because I would say that I was almost encouraged to do something. And the first thing that came to mind was, you know, how do I, in this cultural melting pot where a cultural religion is so strong and the conditionings are so strong, and people are easily scared and they separate themselves through their social or religious identities, how can I meaningfully make a change and allow people to identify with the subject? Because many people have seen and experienced things here without putting them off. And what I like about MUFON is that they do adopt a rigorous scientific method, which Jacques Vallée also tried to or put together. So, you know, it's a one angle that really helps people to come and share their experiences, either openly or confidentially. And there was an incident at the end of 2018 which just prompted me to do it. And basically, I stood in the garden and I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm seeing we're in a developing world country and we need to be compassionate towards, you know, the history and why people are in the situation they're in today. But it comes to a point where we each have to take individual responsibility for our lives and as a society, as a whole. And I said, I think, you know, people need to break their shells to actually understand that there is a greater reality out there that I'm researching, you're researching, and all manner of other people. And it may be just a key to help, you know, unlock, you know, better behavior, let's say, and care towards one another. And again, it was a telepathic kind of experience. I said, at that very moment, I said, look, if there's anyone listening, if you can help me, I'd really appreciate that, because I find it very difficult to see how people treat each other, the fact that they're littering in one of the most precious gems, you know, environmentally in the world. You know, there needs to be a change, and maybe by demonstrating this to people, make them question, allow them to understand themselves and make their own decisions, maybe this is a way to help break the shell open and, you know, evolve towards better kind of behaviors towards one another. And again, at that very moment in time, what I can only describe as a meteorite-type object appeared very low in the sky. It was coming towards me from the west, and it was therefore traveling towards the east. But it was traveling on a perfect horizontal, and it was leaving an enormous trail, and it was traveling very slowly. There was no, you know, inclination or downward type angle that was apparent. The object then reached a parallel with where I was standing, and then it took a 90-degree turn, so traveling from a westerly to easterly direction, then taking a southerly to a northerly direction on a 90-degree angle, and it continued on that trajectory. And it appeared at the very moment at 8 p.m. on that evening in October of 2018 that I thought to myself, please, can you help? There needs to be a sort of demonstration to allow people to question more. Not only that, the next day it was picked up in the national press here in Mauritius. It was also picked up on the sister island of Mauritius in Rodrigues within 10 minutes of that moment, although it was traveling in the opposite direction. And it was also picked up on the French overseas island of Réunion Island, again within 15 minutes in their national press. So again, I suspect this was another sort of multi-dimensional or multiple type apparition, UFO apparition that occurred at the same time, because it would have been impossible for them to travel and be seen at the same time by one object at the sort of speed it was traveling. It was too slow. But it did coincide with this thought process that I was going through. So at that moment in time, I thought, right, I'm going to set up a page on Facebook called Ufology Mauritius and Indian Ocean, and we have around 6,000 members now. And I also wrote to Jan Harzan, the executive director of MUFON, and they were very supportive and grateful for my time. I mean, it's an unpaid role. I just do it because it feels like the right thing to do. So yeah, that's basically what prompted it. After years of incredible experiences and consulting the likes of my friend Timothy Good, the author.
Oh yeah.
And you know, I made some amazing friends along the way who've really helped me and mentored me. And you know, now it feels like the right time to just try and transmit a little bit of information here and there to try and allow people to see union and community instead of pigeonholing, as you said earlier.
6,000 members in a country of that size, that's pretty good. I mean, the level of interest then has to be fairly strong in the general population, or am I overstating it?
I think it's becoming less taboo here. I mean, we're, you know, culturally, we're way behind. I mean, in the States, it's over 90, or I want to say over 90% of U.S. citizens believe in UFOs. In the UK, we're just under about 60%. So here, it's probably going to be significantly less. I mean, certain of the witnesses I've spoken to have had the most amazing experiences, and they were mercilessly ridiculed by people here. I mean, there was a gigantic amount of ignorance that festers on this island. But it's only really by coming out and having sensible conversations and, you know, trying to express our experiences that we're going to see any change. And I think those that know me know that I'm not a complete crackpot. I mean, I am a father of two children. I'm married. I have worked in one of the leading law firms in the world in London, which is part of a Magic Circle group of firms who are international. So, you know, I try to use that as a base of credibility in order to, you know, be heard. But
J.P. Haig, I'll interrupt you there. We're going to go to a break. J.P. Haig is my guest. We're learning about UFO incidents in Mauritius and whether or not they are connected to what we would call paranormal activity. Maybe the connection, J.P., is you. We're going to be right back. We'll open up the phone lines in a bit as well so you can talk to my guest.